folks, and welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, broadcasting at 90.1 M, webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the advocacy organization for all public education employees. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Bob, and we've got some news stories. We've got some very special guests here in the studio, so we want to kind of, besides our underwriting announcements, we want to do the news stories and some quick PSAs and then devote the rest of the time here to Professors James Kilgore and Ken Salo, who are going to be talking about recent developments in South Africa that look like it may have a lot of international implications, and who knows? But Ken just returned. Salo just returned from a trip to South Africa last month, and so he's got some firsthand eyewitness stories to tell us and stuff. So anyway, so I guess we'll start with Bob.
All right. In a vote that just concluded yesterday evening, 3 days of voting at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, South Carolina. It says here, in a defeat that could accelerate the decades-long decline of the United Auto Workers, Volkswagen workers voted against union representation at a Chattanooga, Tennessee plant, which had been seen as organized labor's best chance to expand into the U.S. South. The loss, which was voted at 712 against the union to 626 for the union, capped a sprint finish to a long race and was particularly surprising for UAW supporters because Volkswagen had allowed the union access to the factory and officially stayed neutral on the vote, while most other foreign auto manufacturers have been hostile to organized labor, especially in the South. The UAW had spent more than 2 years organizing and then called a snap election in an agreement with VW. And German unions had worked with the UAW to pressure VW to open its doors to organizers, but anti-union forces dropped the bombshell after the first of 3 days of voting. That was when Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker, the former mayor of Chattanooga, who helped win the VW plant, said on Wednesday that VW would expand the factory if the union was rejected. Needless to say, last night Corker said, "I am thrilled," after the results were disclosed. And National Right to Work Foundation President Mark Mix hailed the outcome. "If UAW union officials cannot win when the odds are so stacked in their favor, perhaps they should reevaluate the product they're selling to workers." An announcement on whether a new seven-passenger crossover vehicle will be produced in Chattanooga or in Mexico could come as early as next week. And that leads us to, it was announced last week when they would hold this election, it was 1,550 auto workers at the plant. Like I say, 712 voted against it and 626 voted for the union. And Corker had originally said that he was going to stay out of this. However, when workers began casting votes on Wednesday, Corker went back on his pledge, issuing a statement saying, "I've had conversations today, and based on those, I am assured that should the workers vote against the UAW, Volkswagen will announce in the coming weeks that it will manufacture its new midsize SUV here in Chattanooga." There's some question as to whether this was legal or not. Typically, in most union elections, unions and companies can't say anything right before the election. However, they say that the challenge about Corker's statements might be difficult, given the broad free speech protection of U.S. senators.
Mm-hmm.
And just a few notes here, that UAW membership has fallen tremendously, almost half since 2001, and in its peak, it once in 1979 had 1.53 million members. Now it has less than 400,000 members.
Oh, wow. I wasn't aware of that big decline since 2001.
Yeah, 380-some. It's actually gone up minusculely the last couple years.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, since 79, 1.53 million down to under 400,000 at this point.
Well, there's definitely some coercion and blackmail involved in this. I mean, of course, given the impression, you know, they're trying to say that, you know, basically holding the workers hostage, you know, work people that need, you know, decent paying jobs and stuff.
We've talked about these tax incentives.
Yes.
And stuff that they give to these corporations, the states and the cities, and everybody hands these out to these corporations, and, you know.
Okay.
It's ridiculous.
Well, another story from the South. North Carolina's Moral Monday movement held a massive moral march in Raleigh, North Carolina, this last Monday, which began at Shaw University, exactly 54 years after North Carolina's trailblazing role in the civil rights movement, with the lunch counter sit-ins. Tens of thousands of activists from all backgrounds, races, and causes marched from Shaw to the North Carolina State Capitol, where they held a rally. Since taking over the legislature in 2010 and the governor's mansion in 2012, controlling state government for the first time in over a century, North Carolina Republicans eliminated the earned income tax credit for 900,000 North Carolinians, refused Medicaid coverage for 500,000 people, ended federal unemployment benefits for 170,000, cut pre-K schooling for 30,000 kids, while shifting $90 million from public education to private charter school vouchers, slashed taxes for the top 5% while raising taxes on the bottom 95%, axed public financing of judicial races, prohibited death row inmates from challenging racially discriminatory verdicts, passed one of the country's most draconian anti-choice laws, and enacted the country's worst voter suppression laws, which mandate strict voter ID, cuts early voting, and eliminates same-day registration, among other things. Wow, that's quite a list. The fierce reaction against these policies led to the Moral Monday movement, with nearly 1,000 activists who were arrested for nonviolent civil disobedience inside the North Carolina General Assembly. Rallies were held in more than 30 cities across North Carolina, and the approval ratings of North Carolina's Republicans have since fallen in the toilet, quote-unquote. If today's rally was an indication, the Moral Monday movement will be bigger and broader in 2014. The North Carolina NAACP estimated that 80 to 100,000 people rallied in a rally, with hundreds of buses converging from all over the state and country. Minister Barber, is his last name, said there's going to be a new wave of direct action protests when the North Carolina legislature returns this spring. So we'll keep you posted on that development.
I got a story out of London. About Barclays, a bank, big major bank over there in London. Barclays said it would axe up to 12,000 jobs this year, even as it raised bonuses for investment bankers, prompting fury among politicians and unions who said it had not learned the lessons of the financial crisis. Britain's third largest bank said up to 9% of their employees could go, including 7,000 in Britain, as it tries to lower costs. The cuts are not concentrated into any one business area. However, it said it paid £2.4 billion, which is about $4 billion in American dollars, in incentive awards last year, raising bonuses at the investment bank by 13% despite a slump in its profits. The average bonus for the investment bank's 26,000-person staff was over $100,000. So critics of the bonus hike said it showed Britain's largest banks were still failing to heed the lessons of a financial crisis caused by dangerous risk-taking and excessive pay. Investment bank income fell 9% last year, and the investment bank made a loss of £329 million just in the fourth quarter. It says here, we need the best people. The higher bonuses lifted the compensation-to-income ratio in the investment bank to 43.2% last year from 40% just in 2012. It says here, the bank said it remained committed to paying out 40 to 50% of its adjusted earnings in dividends to the stockholders. But I guess they don't want to pay their workers.
I guess not. Wow, that's the stop scene.
It is.
Okay, real quick here, we're going to have some public service announcements. There's going to be a town meeting on immigration with candidates, congressional and the U.S. House races. It'll be at tomorrow at the Champaign Public Library from 3 to 5 p.m. The library is located at 200 West Green, sort of along Green Street between State and Randolph. The event is sponsored by the CU Immigration Forum and a host of other local organizations. Also, today, starting at 2 p.m., Brian Dahlner will give a book talk at the Urbana Free Library. And the question of what was life for African Americans in Illinois during the 1930s? Before World War II, President Roosevelt's Work Progress Administration funded a special division of the Illinois Writers Project that employed African Americans living in Illinois. The special program, which was led by Harlem Renaissance poet Arna Bontemps and white writer Jack Conray, encouraged major black voices who lived in Chicago in the 1930s to write about everything from aspects of domestic life to politics, literature, and religion. Novelists Richard Wright and Frank Yerby and dancer choreographer Catherine Dunham were among those who wrote or did research for a projected volume on African American history in Illinois. So anyway, yes, Brian Dahlner will begin that talk tomorrow at the Urbana Library at 2 I'm sorry, today at the Urbana Library at 2 p.m. Also tune in today at 2 for another sports show with fellow worker Neil Parthen at 104.5 WRFU. And you can catch it also on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6. Or if you don't have Comcast, you can watch it at 6 p.m. at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. Also, tomorrow from 4 to 5 p.m. is Labor's Worldview TV with an interview with 103rd State Representative candidate Carol Ammons. So try to tune in for those. And we're going to take a quick music break here, and then we're going to be right back with our guests to talk about developments in South Africa. So stay tuned. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WEFT.
Good feelings inside that make you hum a melody. Hey, friend, and shake your hips so happy. Groove, move like the king of the crop. Shake it, baby, shake, never want to stop. Ooh, my, my, make you wanna fly. Honey, being around you gets me chill, chill, high. Dance, baby, dance like it's never gonna end. Smoothly we groove, break and bend.
Smoothly we groove.
Okay, you're listening to Miriam Makeba, Pata Pata, and anyway, we're back here. You're listening to World Labor Hour on WFT, Listener Support Community Radio Station, with our guests, James, Professor James Kilgore and Professor Ken Salo. We're going to talk about South Africa. Ken, you just recently returned from a trip to South Africa. You're originally from South Africa, so you went back, I assume, to visit family. But I take it that you also got out and about and kind of did some little investigating, if you will.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's been a year since
yes, we indeed. Were in the program. Yes,
exactly. So, yeah, I thought, and we were talking about a very exciting moment, which I think it was great to get back. I was able to go there mainly because I do a study abroad, and so I also reconnect with, you know, some of the worker-based movements at an exciting venue called Community House. And so I meet with organizations, particularly within the form of the International Labor Research Information Group. So I thought I'll give you just a brief note of what was in the news and some of the pamphlets I picked up. And so, yeah, the Workers World Media Project and the International Labor Research Information Group, they put out, you know, pamphlets. And so the headlines would go something like 2013 is a watershed year in South Africa. And this is, you know, or the publication by Amandla, which is also a publication of the Democratic Left, has something like Kusatu, a house divided, and NUMSA battles with Kusatu. And so, and of course, 2014, which is what we now, mm-hmm. is an election year. So I could sense palpably on the streets, you know, the energy around debates. I was there over what was usually a quiet period, mm-hmm. you know, the Christmas recess. But people were in organizing, talking. I met and worked with a housing assembly group. And they were discussing reorganizing and protest. But most significantly, I think the key topic was the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, okay. NUMSA's, their pledge not to support the ANC.
Okay, so NUMSA ANC. Is the, can you tell us, the listeners, yeah. again, what NUMSA is?
Okay, so NUMSA is one of the bigger, if not, I guess, next to the National Union of Mine Workers, is one of the bigger affiliates of the National Federation, the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
Which is COSATU?
Which is the COSATU. The
okay, so that's the equivalent of the RAFL-CIO, more or less, the COSATU.
Exactly.
Okay.
So there's a historic conference in December when, just before, what was that, 2012, that they decided not to support and give funding and support to the upcoming ANC.
Okay, the African National Congress, which is the majority party
in South Africa. Party, right. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of fractures and breaks within, you know, COSATU, but more importantly, realignments within relation to the ruling party, the ANC. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe I'll just quote from an editorial from the ILRI group.
Yeah, before you do that, I want just to refresh any listeners out there, to remind them that the African National Congress, the major party in South Africa, originally started out as a revolutionary group against the racist apartheid government. Is that
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
National Democratic. And they're long, if not the oldest liberation movement mm-hmm. in Africa, in having the origins in the 1920s. So anyway, if there's any moment that sort of characterizes or a descriptor would be there's a sort of a very historic insurrectory or insurgent movement right now. So post-Mandela ANC, it's wide open and there are all sorts of fractures and fault lines emerging, some energy from below. So I'll just, if
sure.
it's okay with you, just quote from the editorial in the Workers' World News. And, it goes as follows. The speed is significant in that it marks a political break with the ANC. There's talk of a need for a new movement that expresses such a political break. But a movement is not the same as a political party, whereas a new movement might give rise to a party which expresses the programmatic vision of that movement. A party without the movement is another election project. So, and they conclude by arguing that currently the seeds of the new movement lie in these community-based struggles, the strike committees, self-organized worker struggles, post-Marikana, which was what we talked about last time of the year, including the mine workers and the farm workers.
Yeah, just to remind everybody, Marikana was when the miners were on strike and the South African police came and just started shooting into the picket line, so to speak, and they killed how many miners?
I think 34. It was the biggest mass killing by the Democratic African National Congress led government.
So this was a watershed moment.
Very much. It kind of echoed the Sharpeville moments on the apartheid era. And so this was one of the key triggers and fault lines. And in the wake of that, we saw this, you know, opening of the debate and, of course, Mandela's demise, and now the historic NUMSA conference, and now the issues around the upcoming 2014 election.
Okay.
So the editorial concludes that preparing for the political debates in 2014 can help speed up this development of a movement, but provided we strengthen and deepen our struggles and not to trade them off against short-term electoral politics. So I think what's interesting is on both hands, there's a call, you know, both for a mass movement with a debate around a program, all right, that will forestall what they saw in the last 20 years as leading it into a sort of election morass, I suppose.
Okay.
But this is not an historic. I want to just maybe in my reading of it remark and refer to two prior periods in South African labor history movement. That's the 1919, the Industrial and Commercial Workers Union, the ICU, during the period of the Depression, 1930s. There was also a moment where they expressed a program that had a political and also an economic project. But the political project always was prioritized over the economic issue. In 1972-73, there was also the Durban strikes by the FOSATU Union, which was a precursor to COSATU. So I would want to sort of connect those threads. And so post-Marikana in now 2014 sort of is again an opportunity where there's huge debate about the interconnection between the political and the economic agendas of a trade union movement.
Well, I remember you guys were on last year. In fact, it seems like what you talked about last year now, what you know, is happening right now and recently, it seems like this development's really accelerated. I mean, last year, would you disagree with that?
No, it's been it's a whirlwind.
Okay.
You know, just as much as the change in South Africa has been, you know, as exhilarating in 94, this has probably been an exhilarating, extremely fast-moving change. So, yeah, the winds of change in Africa are furious.
Okay. And, James, you lived in South Africa for, 12 years?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. What period of time did you live there?
From 1991 to 2002.
Okay. And so what is your take on this?
Okay, well, I mean, during my time there, part of what I did was do trade union education. I did actually quite a lot of work with the National Union of Metal Workers. And I mean, the National Union of Metal Workers has quite a long history of kind of an independent left thread within the organization, which has kind of risen to the fore at this moment. So one of the people that we worked with is Irvin Jim, who is now the general secretary of NUMSA and has been one of the main kind of ideologues in terms of crafting NUMSA's break with the ANC. And I thought I'd just give a couple, quote Irvin Jim a little bit in terms of some of the comments that he's been making both at the NUMSA special conference in December. And then in January, NUMSA held a two-week political school for shop stewards and union leaders to basically reorient the union toward building a movement, building a united front, and building a movement for socialism. So these are quite fundamental shifts within COSATU, and some other unions are beginning to join. So,
okay.
I mean, in terms of characterizing what the ANC has done, Irvin Jim says that the ANC has clearly and unequivocally taken sides with international capital against us. All right. So that's, and so connecting with that, NUMSA is raising the question of to what extent has the economy been transformed, and to what extent have the major resources and enterprises of the country actually been further handed over to international capital, to foreign transnational companies. So NUMSA is opposing that deepening of foreign ownership of the main resources and production of capacity of the economy, calling for nationalization of the mines and calling for a nationalization of the financial sector as well.
Wow, that's that blows my mind. I mean, trying to imagine a similar type of development here in the United States, you know, a major union calling for a nationalization of the banks and some other major industry. I mean, this is interesting.
Right, but I mean, I think as Ken has pointed out, I mean, there's a historical base for this kind of politics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even within the union movement, even during the recent period where a sort of more pro-ANC faction has dominated within COSATU, there have been pockets of a critical perspective within NUMSA, within the South African Municipal Workers Union, within the Chemical Workers Union, and within several other unions within COSATU. So these things have been percolating for a while, but okay. I think we are at a turning point. Marikana was part of that turning point. I also think that the passing away of Nelson Mandela was a turning point because it kind of defined the end of an era. And also in a certain way, it maybe opened up the possibilities for a little bit stronger critique of some of the changes that took place during his years, particularly the shift toward a neoliberal economic policy and leading, NUMSA to take the kind of positions that they are taking, leading once again Irvin Jim to say that the alliance between the African National Congress, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the South African Communist Party, which has held together over the 20 years and which has been a solid block supporting the ANC in elections, in particular with COSATU sending many of its rank and file and officials, both elected and employees of the union, out into the field to campaign during election time. So this alliance, in Irvin Jim's words, has been captured and taken over by right-wing forces.
Okay.
And the solution to that, he's saying, is that the working class needs a political organization committed in theory and practice to socialism. So this, in terms of moving in that direction, NUMSA has begun to reach out to a lot of social movements and community organizations and take up their struggles, the struggles to get housing, to get water, to get electricity, and all the kinds of struggles, particularly for the improvement of the working class living in urban areas. And I know that Ken, when he was there, attended an organization called the Housing Assembly, and it might be interesting to hear what he had to say about that.
Now, just to give a little historical perspective on us, when you first moved to South Africa in 1991, what was happening at that time? I mean, apartheid had just pretty much collapsed, hadn't it?
Well, in 1991, from 1991 to 94, we kind of witnessed the transition period. And there was a lot of contestation going on in terms of what direction the ANC was going to take and what direction a democratic government was going to take, or even what the definition of that democracy might be.
Okay.
And so even at that point, I mean, there were people within the unions who were trying to push for, a more left-wing post-apartheid regime. And I mean, there was the Reconstruction and Development Program, or RDP, was a very progressive program that called for massive kind of reallocation and redistribution of resources in favor of the working class and the rural poor. And that was the electoral campaign platform of the ANC in 1994. Mm-hmm. And the unions and the community organizations were totally behind that. And most of us supported that.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1996, the ANC elected to abandon that program, put in place a neoliberal economic policy called, growth, employment, and redistribution, or GEAR as it's popularly known. And that began a fundamental shift away from a program that was going to significantly benefit the working class. And since that time, there's been a lot of pushing back and forth within the ANC, within COSATU, within the ASA, Communist Party, about what should be their attitude toward GEAR. And I think this has been building for a long, long time, but finally the break has happened with Marikana and with the increasing gap between the rich and the poor and the kind of blatant, conspicuous consumption of a new ruling elite, led by or typified by, Cyril Ramaphosa, the deputy president of the ANC, who is also a former general secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers, but is now a major capitalist owner of mining capital.
Wow. So, Ken, what year did you move from South Africa to the United States?
14 years ago. So, 14 years ago. 5 years after the democratic elections.
Okay. All right.
1994. But yeah, just to continue, I mean, where James has sort of left off. So Irvin Jim represents the embodiment of a particular currency or tradition that's trying to grapple with this, the issue of what is going to be the programmatic or the program, right, for this developer onward. So I'll just give you an idea. And the national, did I say manufacturing? Metal workers, of course. I meant metal workers, I think. So, there's a resurgence in that tendency. But, so the GEAR program is now, according to the deputy president, billionaire Cyril Ramaphosa, that's become, quote unquote, the only game in town. It's now called the National Development Plan. But to give you an idea of the key fault line or the debate is, and I quote here again from the Amandla publication, that the ANC officials, and in this particular case, Gwede Mtashe and Joel Nsenze, have insisted that our revolution is a multi-class and cannot be hostage to a narrow sexual interest. Right, but
now this okay.
So you can see where this is. So they went on to argue it cannot display a working class bias.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the tensions that's coming out, and there's a reinterpretation that this is a break and contradicts the Cossato line from the Freedom Charter that the ANC should be biased towards the poor and the working class. So mm-hmm. there's a major class struggle going around, and the program for developing that.
By saying that they can't be biased to working people, they're automatically showing their bias towards those of wealth and capital.
This is it. So on one level, there's that fault line.
Okay.
Right, as to mm-hmm. whose class interests are going to be best represented by what particular program, and then the strategies and tactics are going to follow. So I can talk to this, and I'm working with a group that's particularly around housing, all right, and they have, it's fascinating and electrifying to have been part of preparation for launch. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the key aspects of course, workers, and again, the unemployment figures are through the roof, but is around housing struggle. So we see this resurgence of labor community, coalitions that beginning to fight together around issues such as housing, but they have an explicitly working class program.
Okay. Let's take a quick music break, and then we're going to come back and talk some more about that and some other issues like water and other things. So you're listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station, WEFT. We'll be right back.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance than the color of his eyes, it's a war that until the basic human rights are equally guaranteed to all without regard to race. And it's a war that until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Okay, that was Bob Marley, and we're back here at the World Labor Hour with Professors James Kilgore and Ken Salo talking about recent developments in South Africa. Ken, you want to talk a little about what's been going on with working people as far as basic needs and services. You started, like before the music break, you were want to talk about housing, but there's other issues as well.
So, yeah, again, just to tie it back, so at the moment, political debates are alive with concerns about what is the new program, and I guess and towards a new movement that's going to express, these struggles. And so I think the idea is that we're going to have to take our cues from what's going on the ground, right? So the seeds of these new programs and movements are going to come out from the community-based struggle. So, yeah, again, and most of these, well, I think there are two ways to think about this. One is to think about it in terms of the, tied back to U.S., one is to think about it as urban, insecure workers. So what do workers need to live in the city? They need a job, they need a house, they need basic services. The other is on the question of rural, or what I think is more important, is immigrant workers. So one way you can think about the Marikana strike is about immigrant workers.
And where do most of the immigrant workers come from?
What was called labor reserves. These are impoverished areas, all right, there was a program to smoke the workers off from their, basically dispossess them of their land.
Okay.
All right, and make them insecure and dependent only on workers. So this is the Marikana issue, where, you know, people like Mombasa and Kwazi, who is quote unquote the man in the green blanket, when you look at what was on their agenda, was both, you know, moving back and forth between the urban, quote unquote, rural, and again the relationship to land insecurity.
So this is internal immigration, basically.
It's internal immigration, yes. But you can think about it in terms of, well, the U.S. and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's the one, you know, part of the question.
Okay,
about where are these seeds, and I think a lot of that is coming from this internal but also international migration, because a lot of the mine workers, in terms of the minerals industrial complex as they call it, was also from Southern Africa. So that's where the main fault line is, or the main shock is coming. Right, but there's also shocks coming in the urban context, where people are protesting over basic services such as housing and water, and so the basic tariffs. So the in terms of numbers and figures, what was the Marikana demand was for 12,500 rand, which is divided by 10, 1,200. And these were skilled ragdoll operators, right? But they typically had extended families to support, both where they were staying in their settlements adjacent to the mines, but also, you know, where they were from. But the militancy question and the independence, and then in the urban context, I mean, the question of land invasions and informal shack dweller movements has just, well, flourish is not quite the right term, but has grown exponentially. So in urban Cape Town, for example, housing insecure people and the demand for land, and it's not the ANC policy for delivery of houses. It's just a sad story, let alone its delivery of land. And again, the program under the ANC was willing buyer, willing seller. That program is under revision at the moment. But in the urban question, shack dwellers are taking over, right, and invading. And so one of the most brutal forms of repression now in Cape Town is what they call the anti-land invasion units. It's people have just brutally been, evicted from shack settlements. And right now, a couple of days ago, people have been, you know, brutally killed and massacred over protests for water. Right, over the lifeline tariffs.
Yes.
You know, and it's at this sort of level. And in fact, that same community that was the victim of this police brutality, if you read their placards, they were also set alight electoral offices for the ANC last week. All right? So they are sure, quote unquote, are not going to vote.
Okay.
All right? Because their demand is coupled in their slogan, no land, no house, no vote.
No land, no house, no vote. Yeah, that seems pretty basic. Wow.
Exactly. And so the ruling party needs to go and explain to them what is the significance of their vote. And so they're not going to be fooled, quote unquote, this time around. But this is what you read daily, right, on the ground. And what was electrifying for me was, so on the other hand, the protests have been prolific, and also mainly in impoverished, you know, informal settlements. But what I noticed different there was the housing assembly is one of the it's the first time there's been a reconvening of what is called a citywide movement. So this is almost like a federal structure, sort of one structure up. So constituencies and delegations were coming to meet, and they had mapped out a program. They had, after a year or two of engaging in a road trip, right, where they had gone to you know, do an outline of or check in on people's needs, and they are now come together and they are now forming an organized federation.
Oh, interesting.
Right, with the explicitly working class constitution, right, and not sort of demanding that the government deliver houses. All right, and they are moving towards these, and sometimes with deadly consequences. All right, and the other significant part of it is that it's young working class women that are taking, you know,
really,
yeah, that's in the front of this leadership. Very brave women who have suffered and endured a whole range of, you know, unspeakable brutalities, but still remain determined and of kind of mutually supporting each other.
Okay, and James, you had some stuff to add to this, of course. You were talking about earlier in the music break that, I mean, you were talking about with the level of unrest in the country of South Africa here, which I thought was pretty profound here.
Right. I mean, I think for several years we've seen what are called service delivery protests. Other people have called it a rebellion of the poor. But as Ken has pointed out, these have been kind of isolated in individual towns and townships and informal settlements. But they've really been escalating in the last 3 months. We've seen about 3,000 protests across the country, and South Africa has once again regained its title as the protest capital of the world, as one scholar put it. But I think one of the things that's been happening is that actually the police and in some cases, you know, members of the ANC have been counterattacking. So in that period, in the first 5 weeks of 2014, I mean, 9 people in different parts of the country were killed for being involved in these protests, either being shot or beaten to death by sort of thug elements. So this is kind of a continuation on a slightly smaller scale of what happened in Marikana.
When you say thug elements, what do you mean? You mean like sort of the equivalent of death squads, like?
I would call them death squads, but I think I would call them kind of like more like maybe like militias or that kind of grouping where they're sort of community enforcers. So they're
okay.
but they're enforcing the rule of the government or the rule of the ANC, depending on the area.
Okay.
And I mean the ANC Youth League has carried out that function in many instances in the past, although I'm not sure about these specific cases. Mm-hmm. So I think we're seeing in the run up to the elections, as one of the cases that Ken mentioned happened in East London, where actually the South African Municipal Workers Union, in conjunction with community protests about service issues, occupied the East London City Hall.
Oh.
And eventually also there was some firebombing of the City Hall. So the resistance is kind of going to levels that we haven't really seen before, and we're seeing that connection between organized labor and community protests. I think a second important thing that's happened is, as a follow-up to Marikana, we've seen a strike in the platinum mines, which began on January 23rd. Once again, this is led by the Associated Mine Workers and Construction Union, or AMCU, which led the strike that resulted in the Marikana massacre in August of last year. And they have about 70,000 members who have had the platinum mines shut for about 3 weeks now, and there's no real end in sight to this. South Africa produces 70% of the platinum in the world. So this, we have major platinum companies, Anglo American and Impala in particular, and they're saying how this is costing the economy, you know, billions and billions, as employers always do. But another interesting aspect of this strike is that NUMSA has now called a solidarity strike, which began in early February, because NUMSA, although they don't have members who are actually underground mine workers, mm-hmm. they do have some skilled workers in metal workers, electricians and that sort of thing, who do work in the mines, and they've pulled their people out. So we now see a connection between the metal workers sector and the mine workers sector. And this is also part of NUMSA's attempt to reshape the way in which they function as a union. So we, So we have the political platform of NUMSA, but we also have them beginning to think about how they can become a broader union rather than just a sectoral or an industrial union, but how they're going to be able to capture other workers who have remained outside the union, perhaps unemployed workers, temporary workers, contract workers, contingent workers, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm seeing this this NUMSA General Secretary presentation by Carl Cloete. It was February 11th at Cape mm-hmm. Town Press Club, and it's man, this is really interesting in the sense that he's, you know, making in his very lengthy speech here, making a connection between the union and these various unorganized workers, but not just workers, but the community, as far as the mm-hmm. community's needs, as you talked about, Ken, as far as the need for basic things like housing and water. I think this is really profound in the sense of not only a union breaking with a major political party of is like the founding party of the current government of South Africa. I mean, this is as significant as if the major union in Britain would break with the Labour Party. And in conjunction with that, them reaching out to this general people in the community for their basic needs. I mean, this sounds like more than just a labor movement. This sounds like, I don't know. You tell me. I mean, this is quite interesting development.
No, I think you're pointing quite rightly, and I said, at the outset, there is historical, precedence that what's up for grabs is actually the program for the future development. And so there has been, and again, this is an election year, calls, sometimes for a new political party. That's one sort of trajectory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other is that I think within NUMSA, the question is the political interpretation of the Freedom Charter and what is the class orientation, of this. And once that program is set in place, its organizing tactics will follow, right? And that might be useful to also mention perhaps another aspect which hasn't yet come into the focus is, I think probably, and I would argue under the leadership of the SACP, the South African Communist Party, COSATU adopted this one industry, one federation notion. If I read Irvin Jim, I think there's also a call for a break of that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there's a move away from this bureaucratic unionism of one, industry, one federation.
Mm-hmm.
They're calling to diversify, right, so that, and we can also sort of then be more democratic. Mm-hmm. So it's an anti-bureaucratic union
yes.
position.
Yes.
Right? And
uh-huh.
I'm sure you guys in the U.S.
Indeed. We'd love to see a similar development
so,
here.
So, yeah, it's a thousand yes. flowers are blooming.
Yes, okay.
Right now. And I think it's a lot will, play itself out, but it's been set in motion by a series of events. And there are certain actors like the Economic Freedom Front, with Malema, who's riding the wave of this, the youth faction, which basically fell out over, economic tender interpretations. So they're trying to capture this wave of mm-hmm. dissent. There's also this Agang party that's trying to capture, some connection to the black consciousness wave. And so these debates are going on. But then I think there's a more fundamental wave, which is beyond the political party reform. This is the question of this new movement or this sort of social movement unionism tradition. And I see evidence for a resurrection of that tradition.
Okay.
And,
go ahead, James.
And I think an important element of that is the fact that, NUMSA, being a metal workers union, is predominantly male. And so by reaching out to these, to the social movements in the community, it's also in involving women and taking up gender issues. And in fact, NUMSA has just elected its first, deputy vice president, female deputy vice president, Christine Olafier. So that's also a big development and draws on the notion, which was pervasive in the 80s and 90s, that workers live in working class communities. Mm-hmm. So workers are not merely workers at the workplace, but they're also workers in the communities where they live. So during that period of the struggle, it was the shop stewards of COSATU who were also the leaders of what were then called the civic associations, which were residents associations, which fought for issues of housing and electricity and water and so forth. So I think we may be seeing a rebirth of that, but with a bigger injection of the social movements of this period, which have a far greater presence of militant women in leadership roles, particularly younger women.
I also found this, from this address by the NUMSA, Deputy General Secretary, where he mentions, I mean, quoting here, I thought this was really interesting. We are a union that was born in the trenches with revolutionary forces within the Liberation Alliance led by the ANC and the SACP. Yet when we speak out clearly in defense of the working class, the poor allies attack us. They call us oppositionists because we reject the neoliberal policies of the ANC and SACP, which attack the interests of our members. They call us ultra-leftists suffering from infantile disorders because we refuse to betray the interests of the working class and support the ANC, whose leadership has consistently attacked working people. And he talks, he goes on to say about the, we're not just talking about labor brokers and we're not talking about e-tolls. I'm not sure what the e-tolls is, but he goes, we're talking about an ANC leadership, which is clearly and unequivocally taking sides with international capital against us. I mean, this is just quite amazing. I mean, you know, this was the Numska evidently has this tradition, which you guys touched on, of being part of the revolution against apartheid. And the fact that they're coming out and making a statement like this, I mean, this is just, you know, you touched on it earlier, but I mean, this is just quite an interesting development. And I'm just wondering how much internationally this has spread. I mean, I know that conditions for the average working people in South Africa have gotten really bad, you know, to kind of, how should I say, add fuel to the fire on this. But, you know, I guess that's what I'm throwing out there is how do you think this might be a sort of a good example that it might spread internationally?
I think that's a great point. And maybe as we kind of wrapping up,
yeah.
I think the other part about social movement unionism is the reality of it is that I don't think at any one point in South African history more than 15% have been unionized.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, of workers. So in other words, the unemployment rate has always been around about and increasingly and now particularly about 40%. And that is more, I think, reflective of the general condition of the world situation.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
This hemorrhaging of work. So the people, I mean, the significance of organized workers has to be revisited in the sea of this unemployed, right, movement of or underemployed or unemployable. And I think this is the tradition within South Africa. This is a sort of longer history. And so there's always been, and what I see in Cape Town, you know, the need to connect with, struggles over housing, and I forgot to mention also struggles over schools. So, for example, let's take Chicago right now. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether the schools, but let's take the CTA.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right? That's for me a great example. Right? Mm-hmm. And again, to what extent they will connect with the housing sort of issue. But I think this, the crisis of under and unemployment is a key area to go and think through further about the role of organized labor, mm-hmm. you know, in social change.
James, any last parting thoughts here?
Well, two things. I mean, one is that within NUMSA and within other unions that are breaking with the ANC, they are looking to trying to find ways to organize the, you know, these people who aren't formally employed, the unemployed, the partially employed, the contingent unions. I know that there's organizations now that are trying to. There's an unemployed workers organization that's part of the NUMSA project. So I think part of what Ken is talking about is redefining unions. And we see that in the United States where there's been so much difficulty getting the traditional unions to take up, the causes of Walmart workers and contract workers and all of those. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an issue. That's an issue that has big implications for the U.S. and for other countries as well. And one other thing is just that NUMSA has begun to do some studies of political parties in other countries. So they're sending out people to study Bolivia, Venezuela, Brazil, and Greece to see what kind of political organization they might want to move toward.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yes, Bob, we have a caller?
Yeah, a quick caller here. He had a question about why did the ANC drink the neoliberal Kool-Aid to begin with? Wondered if it was Mandela's idea and if it was part of maybe a deal for him to get out of prison.
I don't know if there's a short answer to a complex question. we have to deal with the reality as it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to understand what were the political and economic or class forces, you know, that brought about that negotiation. And so, yeah, it's an important question that doesn't have a short answer, but it's significant to revisit to understand what that may mean for the present. And so the question is not the role and relationships of political parties, you know, versus labor unions, and also, you know, corporate capital. I think that for me is the you know, nub of that question.
And maybe we would want to reframe that question to say, not that it was part of a deal to get Mandela out of prison, but it was part of a way to get a certain faction and layer of the ANC into political power, as opposed to a faction within the ANC that had a much greater ties to a working class agenda.
Mm-hmm. So basically, I mean, it seemed that from what I know about Storrow developments is that it, kind of a deal was cut to where, you know, the political system would change, but the economic system would remain intact.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's, and historically, again, when one looks through, one sees these kind of, I don't know, missteps, but lurches. As I said, in the 1930s with the ICU, in the 1970s, FOSATU. And so I don't know if history kind of repeats itself. But
yeah,
there are
trends that, that repeat, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think, and the question again, it's an open moment right now.
Okay.
It could go either way.
Yes, and I find this fascinating that they're actually sending, you know, representatives or delegations to countries like Venezuela and Greece and Bolivia. Yeah, I mean, that's a, I think those, more of those connections need to be made, and that's really exciting too. Although we got to understand that, you know, of course, all this development came from great suffering and repression. I mean, this was not an easy, this did not come out of easy situations, but at least somebody's fighting back. I mean, to me, that's kind of the positive note here, and I'm glad to see it happening. But Ken Salo, James Kilgore, thank you so much for coming into the World Labor Hour again. We might have to make this a tradition, sort of an annual report, if you will, if not maybe a semi-annual.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Always ready, yeah.
Okay, very good. You've been listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Smart Community Radio Station, WFT, broadcasting from Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned after the World Labor Hour for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter. In the meantime, be safe and power to the people. Take care.
Get up, stand up for your right.